Good evening. I'm Herb Kramer, chairman of the BTG Group, and we welcome you tonight. Well, tonight, the BTG Group likes to introduce the up-and-coming decade of automotive electronics. First, I'd like to introduce John Liggett, chief product engineer, Kelsey Hayes. He has his ME from the University of Detroit. Kelsey Hayes was the first one to successfully marriage electronic and electromechanical technology in an automotive anti-skid system. They were the first in the industry. John Liggett?
Kelsey Hayes builds brake systems for cars for many years, clear back to the turn of the century in the wheel business and the brake business. Obviously, we're not an electronic manufacturer, but we know the needs of the automotive industry, and a skid control system has been needed for a very long time, but the technology has not existed to make it a practical product. About 1966, this began to become a very real probability. At that time, Hydro Air Division of Crane Corporation in California was building skid control systems for almost all of the major aircraft marketed in this country at this time, both military and the 707s and 727s and all the things that you people fly frequently. There was a major difference in technology that existed from what was needed in the automotive industry, and that technology difference stemmed largely around the fact that on an aircraft, a skid control system costs something like $1,500 a wheel, and obviously no one wanted to pay that for an automotive vehicle installation. Currently, we sell a skid control system to Ford Motor Company for the order of $75 a car. Recognizing the state of the technology and working from the license base of the aircraft industry and our knowledge of the car industry, we hired some electronic type people and some systems oriented people and started to build a skid control system for a car. Well, shortly after that, we realized we needed a base in the technology of the electrical industry, and our customers, Ford Motor Company at that time, also recognized that need, recognized it so strongly that they didn't really feel comfortable about doing business with us without the expertise of one of the major electronic companies to back us up. We dealt with two or three people who we still deal with at the current time, Brown Engineering Division of Teledyne, and of course Texas Instruments, who builds the electronics we sell to Ford Motor Company. In about 1968, we started a major team effort with Texas Instruments and our own people and the Ford Motor Company, and developed a skid control system first marketed in 1969 Mark III cars, subsequently made standard in that car in 1970 and marketed in the Lincoln and T-Bird cars, still in production and to be extended to the Mercury cars in about 1972. Briefly, for those of you who are interested, our system comprises of three components, an electronic circuit at this time, built of discrete solid-state components, shortly in the future to be made from integrated circuits. It uses a frequency generator for processing information to wheel speed, and a vacuum-powered device to, if you will, pump brakes. Some of the things that we have learned or problems that we've experienced are rather obvious. When we started based on electronic system developed for an aircraft, the cost objectives for a automotive are very different. Obviously, this applies to some of the technology that's in the electronics industries now that's supporting things like computer industries and so on. You have very different cost objectives. Putting it bluntly, they want you to build it for nothing sometimes. Reliability is tough. Some people in their first exposure to the automotive industry feel that reliability may not be as tough as building for the military or putting a rocket on the moon. Well, you may not have to put a rocket on the moon, but that's a few million miles and it's one trip. Everyone expects their car to run every trip for the next 10 years. So you have equally stringent reliability requirements, but expressed differently. When we looked at aircraft systems, an airplane lands on a concrete runway that's either wet, it's been rained upon, or it's dry. If it ices up too bad, they fly the airplane somewhere else. Aside from the technical points of a system. One of the major problems with the electronics industry, and this is expressed as an opinion, is that many of these people have a very different way of doing business than the automotive manufacturers. The automotive people like us to develop a product, bring it in and say, here it is, and let them decide. And we operate on an overhead basis. Our engineering's funded. It's an ongoing thing. Some of the electronics industry, which I've been experienced with, operates on, tell me what you want and I'll build it for you. So we have in this business very much a chicken egg kind of a problem. And maybe I can throw this out to the as a challenge to the speakers as they come up. As I mentioned briefly at the beginning, I see a big new opportunity for electronics in this field. And I'm sure some of these fellows over there got the eggs, and I'm sure Ford and Chrysler and some of our other automotive people need the chickens. And how you guys are going to get it together is the real problem.
In the previous go-rounds with electronics in the car, I think the auto industry was at the forefront of technology. Certainly when the auto radio went in, and particularly when it changed to the semiconductor radio, to a large extent, the auto companies were instrumental in generating a new semiconductor technology, namely the power transistor. When the auto industry converted to automotive diodes, again, that was at the very forefront of the technology. The 15-20-amp diode was developed for the auto industry. More recently, I've been concerned that the auto industry has been following the technology, and I think that's going to be one of the main subjects tonight. We have with us tonight, I think, the top four companies in the semiconductor industry. Actually, the electronics industry has come a fair way, I think, in the auto industry. When you count up what's on the car today, 20 years ago, as I say, you would have counted a radio system. Today, I think all the members of the industry are offering radio, tape, multiplex, and some of us have even had a fling and an abortive fling at TV sets in cars. Speed controls, electronic, are commonplace. Skid controls are beginning to be offered. All three of the big three have them on the market now. Diodes are commonplace in the alternator. Regulators are at least being offered by some companies, not mine. There are some electronic ignition systems on the market. Automatic temperature controls with electronic logic in them are reasonably commonplace. Some of the emission systems have electronics in. There are going to be more. Those of us who like sequential turn flashers have some electronics in that system. One of our notable competitors has a transistorized headlamp delay circuit in it in their cars, and there are others. So slowly it's been creeping in. By and large, it's been creeping in, however, either in low-use options or in some of the systems the industry just hasn't been able to operate without. So with that, I'm going to introduce John Welty first, who's the Vice President of Motorola, and who will give you one slant on the semiconductor view of the auto industry.
Thank you, Chuck. There's nothing like a turncoat, you know, an ex-semiconductor engineer who joins the opposition. The abstract sent out for tonight's meeting says, and I quote, $100 million potential in automotive electronics business looms just 10 years hence. End of quote. Now, if I assume conservatively a 15 million car year in 1980, this figure suggests that we are looking forward to putting about $6 worth of electronics on every automobile. With the variety of applications that I hear discussed both within our industry and within yours, I can only assume that the author of this document assumes that the semiconductor prices will continue to decline at least as rapidly as the automotive prices increase. We at Motorola indeed believe that the potential is much larger than $100 million. But we agree that potential is the right word. There are a number of factors that will determine how large the actual usage becomes. Some of these factors that I would like to discuss are systems thinking, competitiveness, changes in requirements, and then the old bugaboo, make or buy. Systems thinking. It is not clear to me that either the automotive engineer or the semiconductor engineer realizes the systems revolution of which he is a part. The semiconductor engineer would still like to think that he is designing and manufacturing components, which his customer buys and plugs in. This is the environment in which he has grown up and with which he is most familiar. The interface between component manufacturing and equipment manufacturing was clear, and seldom were there any significant questions as to who did what to whom. With the advent of integrated circuits, MSI and LSI, and I should pause at that point because we are guilty of using a great deal of jargon in this business. MSI means medium-scale integration. LSI means large-scale integration. Our definition at Motorola of LSI is that which we cannot build. MSI is defined as that which we can build. Now, I'm not suggesting that that's a universally accepted terminology, but just so you'll at least understand what we mean by it when we talk about it, I'll throw that out to you. In any event, with this advent, the business changed dramatically. The semiconductor engineer is a little like the kid who, after four lessons on the piano, says, "Look, Ma, I'm playing." Except he says, "Look, Ma, I'm designing systems." This may cause some concern among those automotive engineers whose careers have been built designing these self-same systems. Since the automotive organizations have not yet fully understood his dilemma, his assignment has not yet changed. He and his semiconductor cousin miles away both proceed somewhat independently to pursue their separate tasks. The automotive engineer generates specifications, and the semiconductor engineer generates designs, both in blissful ignorance of the problems of the other. The semiconductor engineer should ask, "How can I modify the process to meet the requirements?" And the automotive engineer, "How can I modify the requirements to fit the process?" I further submit that they don't talk to each other very much while this frustrating process is going on. Our organization many years ago organized along product manager lines. The product manager has responsibility for all aspects of his product. We have product managers for things like signal transistors, power transistors, rectifiers, T-squared L digital integrated circuits, linear integrated circuits, and the like. Thus, we have a group of specialists whose main interest is the design and sale of their products to the market. From the outside looking in, it also appears that the auto industry still has a high degree of specialization. I have used the term recently that there are too many titles in the automotive industry, like chief engineer in charge of left front fenders. And indeed, the chief engineer in charge of the left front fender does not often talk to the chief engineer for the right rear taillight. So if I design a gadget, a system that ties the right rear tail lamp to the left front fender, it's not clear who I talk to. I'm not quite sure how I do that, incidentally, but that's a different problem. Engineers specialize on ignition, charging systems, steering, lighting, etc. Neither industry, then, has a heritage of examining the automobile as a complete system. There are two examples of the kind of system questions which could be posed. We have suggested in the past few years that the load dump problem at the alternator could be improved by replacing three rectifiers in the alternator bridge with Zener diodes. These would perhaps add 50 to 60 cents, and please don't consider that a quote, to the cost of the alternator, but would make transient protection, at least that transient emanating from the alternator, much easier to handle for all of the other automotive electronics gadgets, which subsequently get hung on the automobile. Well, who do we discuss this problem with? It is clear that the engineer in charge of alternators is not quite persuaded that he ought to increase his cost 60% on behalf of somebody else. And indeed, he has not. It will obviously increase the cost of the alternator, and the engineers responsible for the alternators can't justify an increase in the cost of the alternator on behalf of someone else in the system's problem. And yet, as you contemplate adding system after system to the automobile, if you have to solve this transient problem on every one of those individual systems, you will materially add to the ultimate cost of the total system, considerably more than the cost of inhibiting this transient from the alternator itself. Another example is a reasonably far-out proposal to put alternating current in the automobile. This should make service motors, such as windshield wipers, seat controls, blowers, etc., cheaper and more controllable. It should have an impact on ignition and lighting. But a solid-state inverter to produce AC cannot be justified for any one of these applications. To whom do we address the system's problem? If electronics are to find their proper place in the automotive environment, we must consider the entire system implications. It is not clear that organizationally, the automotive companies are prepared to deal with the automobile as a system. Competitiveness. We must be careful how we evaluate cost competitiveness in the auto electronics area. I think the remarks I have previously made suggest that a system view may be necessary to demonstrate cost competitiveness. We should avoid substitution of electronics for present electromechanical systems just for the sake of adding electronics. Many of the present electromechanical systems have been manufactured for years, very low cost, and do the functional job very well. Unless there is a cost or functional or reliability advantage, let's leave them alone. What about the cost of semiconductors? I suggest to you that semiconductors are the greatest bargain on the American industrial scene. I keep hearing about inflation. As a purchaser, as a consumer, I understand inflation. As a supplier of semiconductor devices, however, I note that I have been selling solid-state devices at lower prices every year for the past two decades. Competition in our industry has produced a counter-trend to the inflation, which our country has seen. Name me one other commodity code that has shown such a continual price decline in the face of inflationary forces. What is cost? I suggested in the automotive business it should be initial cost plus the cost of warranty. With the systems reservation to which I have referred earlier, initial cost is easy to come by. The warranty picture is a mess. I have seen too many good transistors removed under warranty from radios, or too many good rectifiers removed under warranty from alternators, to feel very comfortable that any automobile company has a good handle on its legitimate warranty problems or costs. One statement I believe the semiconductor industry can still legitimately make is that within the design capability, we still have not determined any wear-out modes for our devices, a statement not shared by most electromechanical devices. I'm not suggesting 100% reliability, but I am addressing myself to wear-out modes. Yeah, we still have a lot of the manufacturing defect kind of problem in the field, but we get very, very few high-mileage failures. Changes in requirements. There are indeed many changes facing the automotive industry today under the twin spurs of safety and pollution control. Systems which did not make economic sense several years ago now appear feasible. If automotive electronics can materially assist in the solution of these problems, it will be up to the automotive engineer to say so. We need to be appraised of significant changes in the boundary conditions surrounding these applications. We need particularly to know what are the cost of competitive methods of solving the problem. I think all too often we get the pricing problem into the act too early. Tell us what the boundary conditions are from a cost point of view, and I submit these are pretty dynamic themselves. A cost that you felt was a reasonable solution to the problem several years ago may or may not be a solution to the problem today. We need to know at least as much as you know about that cost boundary condition. We'll still probably get to our moment of truth on pricing, but you can't even get the thing started if we don't know what the boundary conditions are that we're struggling with. Make or buy. As the purchases of semiconductors increase on the part of the automotive firms, each will purchase many millions of dollars worth. A very significant question is, why shouldn't we make our own? With the kind of future visualized for automotive electronics, it is clear that the automotive firm will continue to be among the largest customers for semiconductor devices. What technology will be required? I have no hesitation in replying, all of them. We believe that to serve the varied needs of this most dynamic industry will require the entire gamut of semiconductor processing. Some applications will best be satisfied by putting discrete components into a circuit board, and other with the most complex LSI chip imaginable. Hybrid techniques will be appropriate to achieve the flexibility in design coupled with proper power handling capability. Only a large and capable semiconductor house with the technical resources in a variety of fields will be able to bring all of the necessary design freedom to bear on the task. I estimate that in today's environment, no automobile firm buys more than $20 million worth of semiconductors per year. This number, incidentally, puts them high on the list of important customers. But if an in-house semiconductor activity is to be set up for the express purpose of serving these needs, they will be a very small semiconductor supplier. The skill required to do the whole job required runs the entire gamut of the semiconductor processing art. Only a very large and competent semiconductor firm will be able to fill the bill. Thank you.
Next speaker is Bernie Vonderschmidt of RCA.
A couple of introductory remarks. This session is entitled The Upcoming Decade of Automotive Electronics for Semiconductor Manufacturers. It's highly improbable that semi-manufacturers alone will be very influential in determining the extent of semiconductor penetration into automotive electronics. The extent and the successful use of solid-state components in automotive electronics will be a function of the team effort of automotive engineers and semi-engineers in affecting systems that are cost-sensitive and reliable. These two conflicting considerations will require all the ingenuity available from both groups and must be a consequence from basic design considerations from a system standpoint and particularly the device technology used, rather than the consequence of screening and preconditioning devices as has been used in the aerospace industry. The discussion will cover the following items. The signal processing circuits, as has been discussed previously, can be divided into two categories. Digital signal processing, that is, digital signal processing is concerned with logic, counting, temporary data storage, and so on. And linear signal processing, which addresses itself to gain blocks interfacing between low-level sensors to provide either voltage and or power gain, wave shaping, comparisons, pre-drivers to power devices, or to simple analog computer functions such as current summing in response to a multiple of weighted inputs. Power devices, which complement the signal processing functions, packaging and overall reliability will also be considered. Let us first consider a technology that could be considered not exclusively, but one that can be considered for digital processing. The basic circuit consists of an inverter comprised of an N-channel enhancement MOS device resulting in a low or zero voltage output. It should be noted that in either state, no current is drawn from the supply except the leakage associated with either the P-channel in the zero state and the sum of the N-channel and gate leakage in the one state. Of particular interest is the fact that there is essentially no shift in the transfer characteristic with temperature and the absolute value of noise immunity, susceptibility to false triggering, is approximately 40% of the supply voltage. By stacking or paralleling devices, basic NOR and NAND gates can be with the same technology. For example, a transmission gate can be made using an inverter plus an N and a P-channel device. In addition, the device in linear parlance has the characteristic of an analog switch, for example. The output replicates the input. By a combination of the transmission gate with the basic inverter, a D or data type flip-flop can be affected. The data is held indefinitely. The system is DC stable. A complete line of standard devices performing all logic functions can be affected with these two basic building blocks, namely the transmission gate and the inverter. As an example of MSI, for example, by the way, I thought it was LSD. I didn't know it was LSI. By expanding with these basic building blocks, any level of complexity can be chosen. The complexity being determined by the cost-effective criteria size of the device. Typical current state-of-the-art complexity devices in production are in the 500 to 1500 device per pellet area, depending upon the specific type of logic or particular type of circuitry we're talking about, where random logic would be on the bottom end, and for example, memory or storage devices would be on the 1500 end. One example of such a device to affect an oscillator and buffer and 23 stages of the flip-flops when operated at, for example, 10 kilohertz input frequency with a 10-volt supply voltage. The power dissipation for this device is 30 microwatts. That is, it draws 3 microamps of current. Although in automotive applications, power requirements may not seem important, we shall look later at the significance of this consideration. The devices will operate over a supply voltage of 3 to 20 volts with, as we noted before, an absolute noise immunity, which is approximately 40% of that supply voltage. The important thing is that the systems are very simple to use and implement. Now, let us address ourselves to linear signal processing. The time at which they are used and are appropriate will be a function of the specific time in any system development. These devices operate over current ranges of, say, for example, 1 microamp to 10 milliamps with voltage sustaining capabilities of 40 volts. To utilize systems which are not necessarily most cost-effective, but which permit the designer flexibility, we can consider making specific customized arrays. I haven't figured out how many different ways 17 transistors can be connected, but it is a fairly high number. For breadboarding purposes, for example, PNP arrays such as these can be used to, with proper external biasing, affect certain functions, for example, loading for NPN devices. The current requirements, because these devices are monolithic, are very low, being somewhere in the region of 1 milliamp. Other types of arrays, for example, with a basic difference being the fact that they have higher current capability, up to 100 milliamps, can be constructed in this fashion. Going along slightly more complex than this, simple gain blocks,
can be used wherein the user can affect his own operating supply, that is his own operating level and his gain, by the use of one external resistor. We can place three of these devices in one package, all of these, for example, again, permitting the user to do his own biasing, depending upon what current output he requires and what gain he requires. To be most cost-effective and simultaneously most reliable, after the system concept has been proved out, custom designs are necessary. The most important item to keep in mind in any system design is to choose the correct technology for the job at hand, considering system reliability and cost. The most effective device to use when requiring high current, high voltage, or a combination of the two is to use a single discrete power device. For slightly higher voltage capability, for example, up to 50 amps, these devices can be used and should be used where current handling is required. These devices take you up to 500 volts, again, with current handling capabilities from 1 amp up to 50 amps. Briefly, let's look rapidly at the current devices used in semiconductor packaging. Due to reliability requirements, it is probable that conventionally bonded devices will be inadequate for automotive control applications, particularly those used in hard fail applications. Beam lead device will probably be necessary before large volume applications can be practical because of reliability requirements. Multiple beam devices can be connected in one package. Beam leads are of prime interest in multiple pellet areas since replacement is possible, and therefore a means is provided for significantly improved yields and lower manufacturing costs if single devices on the package fail and must be removed rather than throwing away the complete package. In some applications, hybrid packaging techniques can be cost-effective. In applications involving high dissipation devices, it may be performance and cost-effective to use hybrid package techniques. In applications where signal processing devices should be an integral part of the package, beam lead devices can be reliably related to power devices from the standpoint of the considerations we talked about before, particularly replacement in case of malfunction of the device that's used in the manufacturing of the device. Now, let us briefly talk about reliability. As has been evident from earlier remarks, selection of the correct technology for the application is the first most important step. We will attempt to define what are the important ground rules for reliability? And we have to consider both the electric, the mechanical, and the electrical environment. Commercial specifications or military specifications may require modulation to be applicable to automotive applications. The most important consideration is to define realistic requirements. Select the best technology and packaging available with a minimum of variation from standard packaging. Temperature cycling requirements, both intrinsic induced temperature changes as well as ambient changes, could impose requirements that do not exist with standard devices. Beam lead or some alternate reliable method of bonding is probably required to meet the reliability standards that the automotive industry will need. The important fact is that 80 to 90% of the IC failures currently used, that is, of ICs currently used, are associated with connections to the die. And the second most important consideration is the electrical environment. High transient voltages associated with integrated circuits and reliability do not mix well. Most of the devices that are returned, when looked at, find fused aluminum, which is evidence of misapplication of voltage. For example, 130 volt, 100 millisecond transient pulses must be buffered from ICs for system reliability. This is the main reason why it is important that power requirements for the signal processing portion of the circuits should be kept low. It makes practical a buffer that can attack fast when a transient occurs, yet can be inexpensive. In the simplest case, a modest size Zener diode and external resistor. If the power requirements are too high, an active buffer is required. The most important considerations are, one, keep the power requirements low on the signal processing circuitry to permit use of a fast-attacking, low-cost buffer. Two, minimize the rise time of the surges on the raw supply so that you can design a buffer that can attack before the voltage rises above a destruction point. And three, use discrete power devices to withstand the transients where current requirements do not permit practical use of a buffer. We may conclude that the extent, then, of the use of solid-state devices in automotive applications will be determined by A, in summary, a team effort by the automotive and semi-engineers in effectively working together, and B, selecting technology and packaging that is cost-effective and reliable by its inherent characteristics. Thank you.